Welcome to the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society. Welcome to ITSP Magazine Podcast Radio. You're about to listen to an episode of Indistinguishable from Magic Podcast with Rafal Loes and Chris Abramson. Chris and Rafal have learned not to take themselves too seriously. Fortunately, they take their profession seriously. This podcast features no-nonsense analysis, seeded with humor, in a way that lets us all laugh at ourselves, while we try to address some of the tough issues in security. Knowledge is power, now more than ever.
What's up, friends? Welcome to Indistinguishable from Magic, the podcast that takes its name from the Arthur C. Clarke quote, "Any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic." Buckle in, because we're not handing out participation trophies, but you know we're going to call some bullshit. My name is Rafal Loes, and joining me is my equally grumpy co-host, Mr. Chris Abramson, and we like to think of ourselves as the Statler and Waldorf of cybersecurity, because, face it, the InfoSec Goat Rodeo could use a couple of clowns. So drinks in hand, let's go.
And once again, we are, I feel like Bruce Buffer, we are live! God, he's got the greatest voice for that, Chris. All right, Indistinguishable from Magic, episode 5 is rolling. Chris, how are you?
I'm good. How are you, Raf?
I'm fantastic. Is it winter time yet by you?
It is 27 degrees outside right now. Yeah, let's just. Let's get past the weather talk. Okay, yes, you live in the South. I live in the godforsaken cold North. I get it. I've already been beaten to death by several other people today about this who live in Southern locations, one of them including a close relation of mine. So, okay.
Oh, that's harsh. That's harsh. I yeah. Changed background. Can you tell? What do you think?
I think I saw a picture of that in a message you sent me. And I'm sitting here going, yeah. Damn, I seriously got to catch up on the bottles. So
yeah, you don't want to do that.
Four upstairs.
I'm already divorced. You might get there if you catch up to me.
Well, no, God, this is the best part. So for those of you who don't know, my wonderful, beautiful, fantastic wife, works in the alcohol industry. That's probably the best way to put it. So
she can get you booze. That's awesome.
Yeah, that's one saving grace of our marriage.
wow.
Yeah. So the booze does come. It's a beautiful picture. I'm going to keep up with you. And on that note, Raf, what are you drinking tonight?
I decided I was going to go for a little bit sweeter tonight. I broke out, I got about a third of the bottle of this Angel's Envy finished rye, and it says rye finished in Caribbean rum casks. And I swear to you, somebody explained it to me. My friend Rodney explained it to me that it's basically like drinking slightly spicy maple syrup that's got a boozy taste to it. I was like, oh, come on, it's made in. And I'm like, nice. I took a sip and went, son of a. Wow. It's but not like the corn syrup, like not like Aunt Jemima maple syrup. No. This is like from a tree, maple syrup, sap, delicious, with a little
Vermont,
bit of
Vermont.
God.
Yeah. Yeah, like straight up Vermont, you know, Vermont.
If you haven't tried this, folks, and if you haven't tried this and you're willing to put $100 into a bottle, it's gorgeous because Angel's Envy makes beautiful bottles, but this is quite delicious. And what do you got?
So I was prepared to do this podcast last night, but somebody ditched me and I was all set with a beautiful ounce of High West Campfire and still enjoyed it.
Ooh,
but tonight I decided to dip back into the Michter's small batch that I have. So I'm nice. I'm enjoying it. This time though, this is the first time I'm enjoying it neat. Because a certain
a proper
person
Glencairn
taught
glass.
Me to drink in a proper Glencairn glass. Yes. So
I'm very excited about that. Cheers to that, man.
Cheers.
I like the fact that you're picking episode topics now, because I can just join as a co-host and just kind of rant along with you. What's the topic today, Chris?
So we're talking about the arrogance that kills big companies. So no. We're talking about acquisition strategy, man. Product. What do you go after? Who do you go after? And how do you execute on that?
Well, you guys are pretty sure I'm going to have an opinion on this, because I worked in some big companies. There's two ways of doing that. Well, there's multiple ways, but there's two spectrums of doing things. Working at HP, I saw them acquire companies in both ways. Working at GE, there was only one way of being acquired. It was literally like watching an episode of Star Trek Next Generation, where the Borg came in, assigned you a number. Yeah, you got a new serial number, and you are now part of the collective. Wait. Your identity is gone.
So when you walked in the door, did the hand come out and the little spikes get you in the neck, and you're just all of a sudden, you know, you just start, you know, replicating into a half man, half machine?
Yeah. I don't remember that exactly, but it was pretty close. Now, I tell you what. So that's one way of doing it. And before you laugh, that's not necessarily the wrong way of doing it. The other extreme is, we're going to acquire you, but we're going to let you keep your own identity, your own management, your own style, your own tools, your own methodologies, but just welcome to the family. And I promise you, that's worse. My colleagues at HP tried both strategies, our leadership there, and then like tried a third one, which is sort of the worst of both those options. And all of that obviously had disastrous consequences, because they don't exist anymore.
You know, most don't after a sorely executed acquisition process.
Or like,
you know, I've seen it. You know, in difference here between the two of us, Raph has worked in the technology industry side of things. I'm more in the other side. The darker side. I don't know.
Some would argue I'm on the dark side, Chris.
Yeah, as I say, some would argue you're on the dark side. But I've seen it executed on our side of the world, and I think we've gone always like and you know, when you're in the business side of it, you know, whether it be retail, manufacturing, whatever. The whole point of an acquisition is to pick up a company that you know is going to, you know, expand your reach, expand your customer base, get your foot into the next thing. And I've seen it done multiple ways. We've done it through you know, we'll let you run as is and, you know, have your own identity. And in some cases it works, because the whole point is for that company to keep that identity, and that's how their customers know them. We've done the full on, we've done the full on rip and replace too. It has its pros and cons, but I think in our industry, when you start to dig into the acquisition side of things, especially when you're a company who's acquiring products or services that are going to, you know, again, extend your reach, pull a new customer base, fill a missing gap that's in your suite of things, or you're just big brother on a buying spree, whatever the show is, there are some definite things that out of the gate you got to consider. And being on the consumer side of it, I've seen some high level execution that I think is fantastic. I've seen some oh dear God execution that makes me want to scream and cry and run the other way.
Yeah, well, I insecurity on the product side and the vendor side, we know there's two case studies for how to do it wrong. One of them is called CA, and then there was Symantec, which was acquisition strategy. Who needs that? Let's just buy a bunch of stuff and see what happens. But you're right though. There's several different ways. And if you're on the buying side, like, I mean, where the chair you sit, you know, in, Chris, you're kind of watching us on the vendor side do the acquisition tango. It's interesting because there's got to be some anxiety. You got a vendor, they're kind of a niche vendor, they're doing well, and you're like, oh man, I just hope, you know, company X that sucks doesn't buy them and screw them all up. But you know, in the back of your head, for them to be successful, somebody's going to buy them, and there's going to be some amount of like crap that gets added or taken away, and you hope that what's left is usable, right?
Well, you do. I mean, you gotta. I mean, you as a buying company, we go out and we're looking for a product to fill something for us, you know, because we either we don't have that or we need that because of some new initiative or something like that. And yeah, that is a fear, is the moment the big company buys the little company, you worry about, and I'm going to start the laundry list here, and you and I can go through this. The first thing you worry about is, what's it going to change in your cost structure? What's your annual maintenance look like? Okay. You know, that's probably fear number one, because a lot of us in the buying seat have to justify the spend. And let's be clear here, and I think anybody who listens to us, either side, because you guys buy too, you got tech that supports you. If your run costs go through, if your run costs go through the roof, guarantee you your executive leadership is going to look at that and go, well, how important really is it to have that newfangled widget that you just bought? Is that really that, you know, is that really needed there? So,
well, I'll give you the flip side of that.
It becomes scary.
I'll give you the flip side of that. The flip side to that is, now, so you've got Acme, large conglomerate, and they've got all these things, and then you want this other thing that's kind of its own standalone, and your boss is going to be like, look, you've got the suite. Do you really need this one standalone thing? And if so, can you give me a really good reason why? And if they get acquired, you're like, look, all I have to do is add that checkbox on the contract. Yeah, we up it by 5%, 10%, 20%, whatever, but now I get more. So that there's a good part to this in that, guys, I've always been a platform play favorite, right? I've always loved a platform play. For better or worse, I think if they can do it right, a bigger company can bring more things together, make them natively work. If they can figure out how not to royally screw that pooch. And the reason I say that is because there have been some really decent acquisitions over the years where you're like, that makes sense. And that's actually pretty well executed, but those are fairly rare. The majority of them are
that's the unicorn. That's the unicorn in this. That is the total unicorn in this. I mean, it is fairly often, and I'm going to go to point number two on my list of why this is can be a show. Oh, dude, I sat up last night and I wrote a list because you ditched me. So second on my list that comes under the really important things to do when you acquire another company, the hell's your customer service plan look like? Because, you know, a little customer service goes a long way with your with people. Okay, I have seen acquisitions where they come in, they, you know, welcome to the fold. Here's where you slot your community platform. Here's where you will upload your material. Here's how our, you know, Salesforce.com platform works to interact with your customers. And it's beautiful. Like, to me, it's a seamless experience.
Yeah.
Then there's company number two. And company number two is, okay, we've bought you. Good luck. And you're logging into this old FTP server to pull down your patches and your slightly older documentation. Your ticket platform is this newfangled thing over here on some, you know, up and coming ticketing system that your parent company built. And over here you have integration with some community platform that's built out on Reddit. It's like, oh my God, please. I don't need 16 different passwords to support my system. I need one place to go to talk with my tech team that's going to help support me as I'm rolling this thing out or as I'm continuing to support it for my business. that's the you know, crap level execution of a platform and the way to piss off a customer really fast and walk away.
Well, you seem to have some experience with this because you've got some oddly specific things you just mentioned. There's a lot of truth to this. I think there's a lot of truth to it. And here's my take. Customer support. I think as a matter of principle, large companies suck at customer support pretty much across the board. There's definitely some exceptions, but scale does not help. Oh, Jesus. Scale does not help your – that's the one place where customers where scale is kind of the killer, right? And that's support. You lose the individual touch. Like you go from – when I worked at Spy Dynamics for like a minute before HP – as HP was acquiring them, right? Support went from like 10 – you know, 8 to 10 people that customers could all call by name and pretty much knew where they were to – one of 500 people at the other end of a call center that they were never ever going to understand, and I mean that linguistically, or ever talk to more than once, unlikely, right? So there is something to be said for that personal touch, that ability to reach out and touch your customer that large companies just can't do.
It's hard to do because what you're trying to do is economies of scale. You're trying to, you're trying to bring this in. You're trying to integrate it into your overall portfolio of sellable services, and you integrate the customer service into your larger customer service organization. I think that's your point. Is that large companies have a hard time doing customer service at scale because what happens is that you have to onboard people real fast. You're growing it. The first level tech is, you know, barely 2 weeks old in the company and doesn't understand how the product works. Whereas most of the people who were working customer service before the company was bought up all grew up with the company. They knew which developer or engineer or product analyst knew exactly how to solve the problem that the customer was having. That it really comes down to, and we've joked about this, and not Raph and I, but you know, my own folks that work with me and even other companies I've talked to, we've joked about this, but it comes down to a little customer service goes a long way. It really, really, really makes the difference in how you execute and how you retain customers on that platform, and even potentially sell customers on the other parts of your solution pack that they would not have potentially bought because of the fact that they were using that one-off company that you bought.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. There's a point number three. What's point number three?
Point number three, the sales guy.
Oh, crap. Well,
the sales guy. I know this is home, buddy.
You take a sip. I'll start, then I'll let you go because I think you've got more to say. Listen, I in deference to all my sales friends in sales, and I have been adjacent or indirect, as a technical resource or adjacent to that group. I've managed a group of technical resources for sales. Sales at a smaller company, it's definitely more personal. It's definitely more. I don't know, like when your renewal is up and I'm your salesperson, I call you. When your renewal is up with HP, somebody from Costa Rica or wherever our call center was would probably call you. And sometimes they would know, sometimes they would forget, which is weird, right? And sometimes you're like, who are you? What are you calling about? Like, I don't understand. Why are you? Wait, why are you calling me and not my sale? Right. So that seems to be. Like this comes down to a lot of these things come down to like that personal capability, personal touch. Now, I will tell you, I'll tell you that sales reps at bigger companies have more room to hide. So there's potential for more incompetence. as a sales rep, and they won't know as much, but they'll know more of this of the swath. So the good news is you're more likely to be able to talk to and have a reliance on your technical pre-sales solutions consultant, solutions engineer, solutions mm-hmm. architect, whatever you call them.
Yep.
But yeah, I think oh gosh, I'm interested to hear what you're going to say. I'm just going to take a nice long sip over here.
Long step over there while I rant on. No, I think you hit the nail on the head. You know, in the small company pre-acquisition, the sales team, there's a strategy. From the owner down to the engineers, to the sales team, to the, you know, if by chance there's pre-sales engineering or technical engineering that goes out with the sales guys, because sometimes, you know, if you're small, you're all kind of wearing multiple hats. But there is a level of, I don't want to screw this up. I want to be transparent. I want to be honest with you as your representative of this company. And I want to give you the best experience possible. Okay. And this might go back to the scale thing that you were talking about. Enter large company. And now you might not just have one salesperson or account exec or rep. You might have, you know, an outside rep, an inside rep, a sitting next to you on the train rep, the rep that's calling you at 2 a.m. to remind you about something.
I've got one for you. Okay, this is you guys are going to laugh. When I worked for HP and what was back was enterprise security products was a thing. Literally. I was in a meeting where the customer had their chief information security officer and the lady's admin or like her chief of staff or whatever, to two people on the customer side. I, on the other hand, on my side of the table, was the account manager, the enterprise account manager who had basically like four or five major accounts like this, right? This is a Fortune 100. Mm-hmm. You had the regional sales manager, so that person's boss. You had the sales specialist. Sorry, security specialist that knew that was a sales manager for all the security line of product. You had the security product specialist that knew that particular piece of the security pie, AppSec in this case. You had myself, the pre-sales consultant slash engineer. And so that's overwhelming. And when we started having like bigger meetings, you'd have like somebody from the network team, somebody from the enterprise security services team, somebody from the printers team, somebody from the PC, somebody from server, somebody from cloud, somebody from this, somebody from that. And you're like, why do we have 9 people in a meeting with a customer that's got one? Like, you guys not understand how this works? This is terrible. But you're right. You get that massively fractured customer experience in sales, and yeah, that's just one of my stories.
I do want to be fair to the sales teams, because I've met some really fantastic salespeople. I've worked with some amazing account reps, and I don't want to downplay their role in a company, big or small. Okay, everybody has a role, you know, to play, but it does become fundamentally tough when you start to when you either need something, need to talk to somebody, that's where the roles come in. It's like, do I call my inside sales guy? Do I call my outside sales guy? Do I call my
renewal specialist,
my pre-sales engineer, my post-sales engineer, my renewal specialist, who am I calling for what? Because in some cases it ain't clear. It just fundamentally is not clear who's going to take the problem on. But then what you have is like, I I'm not kidding. I had to do this the other day. I had to email like the entire team, because when I emailed the one person out on vacation, so now it becomes like, okay, well, so-and-so's out on vacation, you know, so I'll go to the other person. The other person fortunately did pick up my email and stuff, but strategically speaking, when you're trying to get in touch with somebody about something, or escalate, or you know, make another license purchase, whatever it is, it does become fundamentally tough in a role perspective to understand that. And that's the thing with the small companies, is it just you have frankly, you want the one throat to choke, as most people would say, you know, and yeah. that's where the small companies, I think, execute at the rate they can, because they're it's a very personal experience. And even when you sit on the side of the table in a big company that's buying, some people like that personal experience. So.
And that's 100,000% fair. I'll tell you, sales is always tricky, because you want to be able to, especially in large companies, and you want to be able to sell, but you also want to be able to give you a personal touch and cover more accounts and all that. All right. How many points do we have? Do you have a point number four?
Hold on.
This is a half hour podcast, dude. You got 6 minutes to go. Come on now.
I know. No, I point four. I think I'm going to let it go. I'm just going to let it go.
Let's talk about let's talk about product strategy.
Sure. Let's talk about that.
I'll kick that one off.
Funny that you mentioned that, because that I think actually was point four. Wow. Yeah.
Well, so let's go ahead and hit that one, because there are we're talking about arrogance killing products. There is so much time spent where big companies acquire small company and go, let me tell you how it is. Let me tell you how to make money. Let me tell you all these things. And you're like, okay, but I know my market. I know how we sell. I know what my customers want. And that it makes it kind of difficult. So the product strategy tends to melt away into a bigger picture. That assumes, and that it should not assume, that that company acquiring you has a bigger picture. Now, case in point, I take you to my one of my favorite whipping boys over here, a company called Symantec.
oh man,
they look. I've got lots of friends that have worked there over the years. It's not been the worst. But what the hell happened? Like, what the hell happened? You guys started as a security company. You decided you're going to buy a bunch of stuff that's like security adjacent. DLP and backup and whatnot, had no idea what to do with it. Like, Raph, none.
This is what happens when an AV company buys an encryption platform and then buys a proxy platform.
Why?
Hold on, Mr. Platform. Let's get you on the platform. That's the point.
But look, Bluecoat buying Symantec, Bluecoat, right? Yeah. Well, that was a reverse acquisition, because what was left was Bluecoat with a bunch of Symantec people reporting to them. But look, you've got to have a reason you're buying this piece over here.
Yeah.
Because you have a thing, you have a platform, and you're missing something, right? Because this is the reality.
Well,
as a big company, hold on. As a big company, I'm just going to explain this real quick. As a big company, you are implementing, and you can get scale, you can get distribution, you can get cost benefits, etc. As a small company, you can innovate. Big companies cannot innovate. The end. Period. No doubt about it. You can try to convince me. I've been all that. Cannot. Because they are driven by profits. They are driven by boards of directors. They are driven by customer value. Blah blah blah. Shareholder value. Sorry, those are not the same. They cannot innovate.
Hold on.
Can't do it.
I think a big company can be innovative. And that is based on the ability to execute an acquisition strategy that complements the platform that they are trying to build.
Okay, so cheaters innovation. I gotcha. That's I can get along with that. So going back to my point, you acquire a smaller company because it complements a missing piece that you don't have, right? We talk about this feature economy. It's a feature, not a product. You buy the company, and because they're a feature in your product set, you're like, yes, you complete me, vendor Q over here, and now I have a thing, and this platform is massive, and we're going to work. And then you take away – you have to take away you have to take away all the downsides of being a small company, and that is the ability, you know, the lack of scale, the lack of actual investment, blah, 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 distribution, and da, 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 da. Like, how many small companies small, and how many small companies can get global distribution well done, a global supply chain? Very few. But you also have to balance that out with, like, what is the purpose of this acquisition? What is a long-term strategy? And what is the Jerry Maguire, you complete me line? Like, why are you buying them? And can you continue to keep the leadership, the spirit of the organization, and at least the innovation trajectory? They're not going to come up with anything earth-shaking right there, but at least keep that going. All right. And the reason for that is, almost done. And the reason for that is the result, if you don't get that right, is you end up with a couple of things that look like they belong together, but they're the awkward, you know, kids at the boys and girls dance at eighth grade, where you like, okay, you know, you two should dance together. You look really good together. And you're like, all right, I'll put my hands on her hips and she puts her hands on my shoulders and we both move to the left, to the right, to the left, to the right. And as soon as the music's over, we run off to our corners. Uh-oh. Because nobody has any idea. Like, we are terrified of each other. I know, terrible analogy, but that's all I could come up with. But that's my fear. And I watched HP do it. Symantec is the king of it. I'd say CA did it. But I mean, like, even McAfee tried it, like, post Cuckoo Man. IBM, like, they bought ISS. You're like, oh, right, ISS. What are they going to do with that? Nothing. Devastation, budget cuts. We're going to cut, you know, yep. We're going to make it efficient. We're going to lean it out. We're going to be like, no, that's not what made them great.
Moving along. I think there's a quote here that needs to be said, as spoken by Peter Drucker. If anybody, you know, reads Drucker and follows, you know, the business aspect side of things, but culture eats strategy for breakfast.
Yes.
And I think what ends up happening is these, all day long. And I think what happens is these large companies, they step in and it's their culture. It's how they absorb and their unwillingness to waver to actually drive a better strategy of acquisition design and really say to themselves, am I acquiring this just for the customer base and the revenue, or am I actually acquiring this to make it part of my larger portfolio set that I'm going to offer to a customer and make it better and do better? And I think, unfortunately, you know, as we've seen from the companies that you've listed off so kindly,
I've got one more before you're done.
But culture eats the strategy for breakfast, and ultimately what ends up happening is, to your point, is it revenue meeting street numbers, you know, drives the overall model. And that's the unfortunate part is that you take good products, stuff that could have been very innovative, very structurally sound to what it was that it was meant to do, and it just gets run into the ground, unfortunately. But on the flip side, what that breeds, and I think you and I've seen it time and time again. I know you've got a larger friend base than I do on the Twitterverse and just in general, you know, with the people that you know through conferences and stuff. But it's bred new innovation. A lot of engineers, yeah, and a lot of people have left these companies and they've gone out on their own and they just were like, I'm gonna do it better, different. And I'm going to keep that personal touch.
So
until the check comes in, until the check clears.
on the point of culture eats strategy for breakfast. Let's talk about the Optiv, which was the Accuvant and Fishnet hostile takeover. Don't call it a hostile takeover. We'll call it a merger, which it wasn't. But look, here's what – I mean, the reality is what happened. You had a company, Fishnet, that was fantastic at services, right? Sucked at a VAR.
Oh, yeah.
Accuvant, great VAR, couldn't do services to save its life. So here comes an investment firm and says, you know what would be great? If we stuck you guys together. Turns out that you can't get two companies that hate each other at the visceral managerial personal level – have competed for many years, even when you throw money at them, and then selectively leave one company in charge of the whole thing, except for one piece, which is the other company, And then they like selectively fire the other company's people, and you get lots of it. And it turns out no matter how great of an idea that was, the result was catastrophic leadership infighting, right? Cycle after cycle of restructuring, reorganizing, and KPMG and Blackstone and some of the hires at the executive level we made, sweet mother of mercy. We're not going to go there because somebody will call, a lawyer will call me. But let's put it this way. There were people that were dumpster fires in terms of like HR that somehow ended up with an executive title. And you're like, what? Who did you have pictures of or owe a favor to? Like, who owes you a favor that you are in that spot? Because you are nowhere near qualified.
But there you go. Culture ate strategy.
Absolutely.
No one bought into the strategy. Because if you stop and look at the flip side of it, it could have been it could have not been catastrophic. That could have been the next large security organization in the U.S.
In spite of itself. That they are still an amazing company.
Yeah, driving massive like projects, change strategy designs for large companies. Because I knew some really great people that worked at that company, present company excluded. Were some just amazingly smart people, and that's the pitfall of the backfired acquisition strategy is that you now have lost all of that fantastic brain power and skill and just strategic capability because of the fact that no one bought into the strategy and everybody the culture clashed.
And it
fought against it. No pun intended, folks, but the virus was inserted and it spread like wildfire. And, that is the downfall of a poorly executed acquisition design structure. And it's all because nobody bought into it.
I think that you're right. I think that M&A tends to be one of, in companies like that, should really be staffed by the best and brightest and people that have done it, but not just people that have been on the acquiring side and life look like career at big company people, but they should every once in a while refresh those ranks with people that have been acquired because they know what it's like and they know what's missing. And
yep,
the extremes are equally bad. Bringing somebody in and saying your identity starting tomorrow is gone. Here's who you are now. You're one of us. You know, like all your brand identity, your company ceases to exist today. You're big corp X. That sucks. That fails. The opposite is just as bad because you get this. Well, you know, we're special. We're not part of you guys. We do things our own way. And you're like, but you're part of the big, like you're part of, megacorp. Like, yeah. But we don't have to worry about what you guys do. We have our own, we have our own kickoff, sales kickoff, and we have our own budgets and we use our own tools and we can do things our own way. And you're like, well, then again, there's no cultural meld. And so that's going to suck. So I guess what we're saying is, there's two things that are important here. Culture and strategy. And if the fit isn't good on both, you'll end up failing. And that's what makes M&A so tough. And that's why there's so few good acquisitions. And we don't need to go through them all. Cause you guys, look around every one of you guys listening has a couple of vendors that you're like, why did they get acquired by name your big company? Like, oh, you were so good until like 3 months ago when you guys got acquired. And
it's sad. I mean, it will, and you and I both know it's not going to stop. I can't believe I'm going to use this term. Every two or three years, there is a calling of the herd. It happens.
Well, we got to end because Chris just said the magic words.
Calling of the herd. That's the final word for tonight.
Final. That's not a word. No,
I know. We'll get to the final word.
All right. Well, that's a good place for us to end, because I think we can just rant. But culture and strategy, balance those out. If you're on the acquiring side, you're on the megacorp side, make sure you always balance those out. If you're on the customer side and your company's getting acquired, you know, your favorite vendor's getting acquired, you've got some potentially huge upside to look forward to, but you've also got some huge downside to look forward to. So trying to figure it out. I mean, if I'd say, you know, give them a chance, because M&A is super hard. It's super hard to get right. It's super hard with all the pressures to, you know, get return on investment, get value, cost optimize. And I could throw buzzwords at you all day, but it's hard. It's really hard, but it's also, it shouldn't be that difficult, and it shouldn't be a failure rate of 85 to 90%.
No, in essence, God, I hope, you know, some folks are listening that have, you know, any idea of, you know, or have say in how some of this stuff is done. But man, the points I said, it, you know, customer service, sales strategy, and I forgot what the first one was. Well, the whiskey went straight to my head tonight. But you know, seriously, give that some thought, because it's those things. And if you're the small company, fight for some of this stuff. If you're looking to get acquired, make sure that you set the tone with the company that's acquiring you. Like, how is this going to help? How is this going to work if my customer base all of a sudden now has a crappy customer service structure and the sales guy is based out of California, you know, and we're here.
Yeah,
just saying, your biggest customer base is your ones closest to home. So,
yeah, I'm telling you, one of the only guys that I worked alongside or worked under that did it right was a great guy named Bill Vecti at HP. He got it, but unfortunately, they didn't let him. Like, the people underneath him, like, his vision was good. The people underneath him were terrible, and they didn't quite, like, they talked a good party line, but as soon as, you know, it came down to execution, it was bad. But I miss working for Bill. Bill was good people. He understood some of the cultural stuff, the softer side of that business. And he's off doing some awesome stuff. But hopefully, I tell you what, you know, we should listen to PE firms. If you're out there, you know, you're saving, rescuing companies. This is a big deal. You guys know this. I'm not telling you anything new. Maybe just reminding you. All right, Chris, we're going to do this final word. Please don't make it stupid.
No, I think in the spirit of what's going on this week, Raf, vaccines.
Vaccines. Ladies and gentlemen, that was the final word. I'm Raf. That's Chris. We're the Statler and Waldorf of cybersecurity. This is Indistinguishable from Magic. Thanks for listening. We hope that you share these episodes. We hope that you enjoy them. We hope that maybe you're even nodding along. And so let us know you're listening. We'll catch you guys later. Have a great afternoon, evening, morning, night. I don't know, whatever, wherever you are. I don't care. Have a great one. Bye.
Bye-bye.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Indistinguishable from Magic podcast with Rafal Loos and Chris Abramson. If you learned something new and this conversation made you think, then share ITSPmagazine.com with your friends, family, and colleagues. If you represent a company and wish to associate your brand with our conversations, sponsor one or more of our podcast channels. We hope you will come back for more stories and follow us on our journey. You can always find us at the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society.